I don't wanna be the boy that runs in the back. I don't wanna be the kid that falls in the dark. All I really want to be is the guy that gets that girl.
Welcome to the AJ Steele Show. We discuss politics, sex, money, and everything in between. And now, here's your host, an immigrant, a self-made millionaire, an American, AJ Steele.
Welcome to the AJ Steele Show. Where do I start? Today's show is explosive in many ways because the topic is controversial and potentially dangerous in some aspects. I can't even begin to tell you how many emails and posts from listeners and phone calls from friends I've been getting that ask me the exact same question over and over again. Now, these people are patriots of every race, every gender, every color. They're people who love America and feel helpless as they watch their country circling the drain. They tell me that they pay their taxes, they follow the rules, they vote, and they always do the right thing. But they feel that their voice just doesn't count anymore. And they're right. Their needs are ignored by our government, and their children's futures are uncertain. This is not the America we grew up in, they tell me. This is like a horrible nightmare that keeps getting worse and worse. And when I tell them to do something about it, to fight back, they all ask me the same question. AJ, how do we fight back? What can we do about it? So as you can tell, this has been really troubling me, and I've thought about it long and hard, and I even decided to interview a writer named Christopher Adamo, who wrote an important book called Rules for Defeating Radicals. But before we get to talk to him, I wanted to speak to you about the limited options that we have left, and start talking about dangerous things like revolutions, and equally volatile but legal ways to fight back, like peaceful mass resistance. Now, please don't think that I'm overlooking traditional methods of fighting back, like getting out the vote, campaigning, running for local office, and changing hearts and minds. But what happens if we do all of those things and our votes are stolen or remain uncounted? What do we do when our God-given rights are taken away and our Constitution is ignored? What happens if the government takes away our ability to work and freezes our bank accounts, or even worse, puts us in jail for no reason? For no reason other than the fact that they don't like our politics. What happens if our courts have become so corrupt or so beholden to Big Brother that they stop upholding our Constitution and stop enforcing our laws? I know that I'm asking a lot of what-if questions, but how many of you have heard of good people who lost their job because they refused to take a vaccine? How many of you have heard of patriots who are still locked up for peacefully walking into the Capitol building on January 6th? How many of you have heard of an American president who was completely erased and banned from all social media and the news? An American president. And I know that none of you have forgotten about the Canadian truckers who lost their licenses and the ability to feed their children because they dared to protest that progressive globalist pig, Justin Trudeau, right next door in Canada. You think these things can't happen to you? I wouldn't bet against that. Another comment I get from some listeners is, get your guns ready, buy plenty of ammo, because we're getting ready to fight. Well, fighting the government is a revolution, and revolutions are never too pretty, especially in an era when you have a woke, compliant military and police which have demonstrated very clearly that they will stand with their globalist masters against their own American brothers and sisters every time. I've seen it with my own two eyes, close to my home, and I spoke about it in a previous show. So no, I don't advocate for a violent revolution. Too many good people would get hurt, and America would be over for good. Having said all that, I'm telling you that I would absolutely take up arms and fight till death to protect my family, my friends, and my liberty. And I would encourage anyone who's presented with such dangers to do the exact same thing. I also want you to understand that I'm not saying that we couldn't reach a situation when we have to revolt against our oppressors, because sometimes that's the only option left. But I don't think that we're at that point yet. And I have some better and much more practical ideas on how to win our nation back peacefully. In the 1920s, India had a leader named Mahatma Gandhi. His nation was occupied and abused by the British, but he knew that there was no way to defeat them militarily. So he devised an incredible system of acts, which became known as civil disobedience, or non-cooperation, as he called it. He started a series of mass strikes and walkouts that crippled the entire nation. And then, to add insult to injury, he instituted huge boycotts where average Indians just plainly refused to buy anything that was made by the British. All this was done on a mass scale and included huge marches and protests. And lo and behold, the British Empire gave up on India, and India became an independent nation in 1947. And I think you might recall another great man who really studied Gandhi's methods and succeeded in getting his own people equal rights. His name was Martin Luther King Jr. Both Gandhi and King understood the power of the purse and the visual power of peaceful protest. And that's the only direction I see conservatives heading. That's the only way we can win. It would be very hard for our police officers and military to shoot us or arrest all of us if hundreds of thousands of us were marching peacefully. It would be very difficult for them to lock up millions of us if we refuse to pay our taxes. And what happens if millions of us stop sending our kids to public schools that indoctrinate them into the LGBTQ insanity and tell them that they're racists for the simple reason that they were born white? You think Child Protective Services can arrest millions of parents? You think they can arrest all of us? And what about boycotts? The whole nation, with our greedy globalist overlords, will be hard-pressed to keep oppressing us and continue to destroy our national will and flaunt our laws and morals if we stop buying their products. Even better, if our labor force went on a huge strike, then the globalists wouldn't have any products to sell in the first place, or even the employees to sell it. But none of this stuff works until we stop being selfish and start acting like a giant community of Americans. It won't work if most Americans stay apathetic and obsessed with their social media and their mindless entertainment or their booze and their drugs. That's exactly what the Democrats and the globalist bosses are counting on. They're absolutely counting on us to stay selfish, to stay distracted, and to never unify. Divide and conquer. Divide and conquer. So in the meantime, what can I do? I will keep spreading the word. And I will keep doing my best to convince people to wake up. And I hope that all of you do the same exact thing. We have one nation to save. And if we don't fight for it now, we might never get a second chance to do it again. My dear friends, before we start our interview with author Chris Adamo and hear all about his book, Rules for Defeating Radicals, I'd like to say a special thank you to all of our wonderful listeners in the USA and the rest of the world. Our ratings and subscriptions are going through the roof, and we keep beating a lot of the much more famous corporate conservative talk show hosts in some very major demographics. So thank you for your continued support, and I hope that you keep telling everyone you know about the AJ Steel Show. This is AJ Steel, and we will be right back.
The AJ Steel Show. Think of your loudmouth best friend, hated by all the wives, because he tells it just like it is.
Your love belongs to me.
Hello, Christopher. Welcome to the AJ Steel Show. You have just written a fascinating new book, which is a clever take or perhaps a rebuttal to a very influential 1970s book called Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky. Before we start talking about your philosophy, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to write your book.
Okay, well, I'd have to say I was a lifelong conservative. I grew up during the 1960s, I was a big fan of the space program, watching us race the Russians to the moon. And I, in the process, was picking up on the political implications of that. It wasn't all about space travel. I grew up as a conservative just in my heart. Well, then in 1974, I became a Christian, and I came to the realization that a good majority of my conservative principles were, in fact, aligned with what it is to be a Christian. And so I'm a Christian first. I'm a conservative. I went into the Air Force. I was in aerospace after that for a while. But during this time, I'm watching the events going on around me during the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. And then I began writing a conservative commentary that appeared on several sites. I've been on Newsmax a little bit. That was many years back, an American Thinker and a few others. But during the whole time, and I was living in Wyoming during this period. I want to add that because in Wyoming, because you have such a low population density, you have literally 500,000 people in the whole state. The chances of knowing the governor on the first name basis is much higher than knowing the mayor of many big cities. And so you get involved with the political process. And throughout this time, I'm watching our side, real America, losing battles to the left that we should be winning. And we lose them because we go into the game and we play by their rules. And somehow we keep falling for their scams and tricks. And it was, you know, very frustrating. And I'm thinking, they shouldn't get away with this. Look what they just did. This is glaring hypocrisy. This is totally disingenuous. Why are they getting away with this? Well, eventually I realized it's because they're playing on the Alinsky strategy. They know the dirty tricks. And our side is, we're out there like a bunch of naive dupes expecting them to play fair. And what we end up doing is walking into their snares and we lose. Well, somebody needs to write a book about this. Okay, after several years of saying somebody needs to write a book about this, I realized it wasn't happening. And so at that point, I thought, well, I never thought I was up to writing a book, but I'm going to do this. I've written a bunch of commentaries, but they're about a page or two long. So I started writing the book.
So we all know that many of the newer progressive politicians and even some of the older ones like Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Rahm Emanuel, all of them embraced Alinsky's book. In a way, it's become their Bible or a type of a roadmap on how to get to power and how to transform our nation into some kind of a radical utopian nightmare that none of us even recognize anymore. To me, it's obvious that most conservatives fell right into Alinsky's trap. It seems that they're always playing defense. Why?
That nails it. What you just said, they're always playing defense. It's part of the scheme. When you look at the Alinsky strategy, the goal is to get them on the moral high ground in every argument on any available premise. And the things that they'll pull out of the air to claim their moral superiority are, I mean, they go beyond absurd. The thing to notice about them is that in the very next breath, they'll totally contradict themselves when they've moved on to the next argument. So they do this and they get away with it because we let them. I have two basic premises in my book. The first one is that the Alinsky strategy only works on those who allow it. And I say this throughout the book to remind people, because we don't have to let them get away with this. It only works when we accept their premise. And we fall into that, as you say, defensive response. The other thing that became apparent, and I was literally learning and growing as I'm writing this book, the other thing that became apparent was that leftists never care about any cause they claim to champion. They only care about using the situation to advance their agenda, which is power and control. And when I say any, I've had even some conservatives kind of confront me about it. That's a little bit excessive because I'm using a blanket statement. Well, I will stand by that statement 100%. I can show you, any, you pick any issue you want and say, well, they really care about this here. And I can show you where, no, they don't. They'll totally abandon that issue and jump on the other side of it in the next breath if they think they can use that to gain leverage over us, because that's their game.
You're 100% correct. So we conservatives, we seem to lose each and every cultural war that we're facing. And yet, when we got Donald Trump as president, and he was a fighter, and he had no problem taking it to the progressives, all I heard from the genteel country club Republicans was that he's too rude. He's too rough. He tweets too much. It's either that these so-called Republicans are a bunch of masochists who enjoy losing, or could it be that they were never on our team to begin with?
I would agree with you. I would say that the biggest single achievement of the Trump presidency, above all the international treaties, the wonderful things he did, energy independence, building our manufacturing base, the booming of the economy. I mean, the single thing that he accomplished that's above and beyond that was exposing the duplicity of the rhinos in the GOP. he exposed the element in the GOP that claims to be with us that never was. When I started my book, I had intended to write it as a, here's what Alinsky says, here's what I'm going to say. And then I came to the realization, first of all, Alinsky wrote his book in 1971, and so things have morphed since then. I say they've metastasized since then. And so we can't just be becoming an expert on what he did in 71 is not really going to help us. Now we've got to apply it to the situation. So as I was writing the book, it began to morph into, I need to forget about a point by point against Alinsky, but I need to go into who are the left now, mainly as a result of Alinsky, but who are they now? How do they operate? And how do we deal with them? And in the process, I suddenly realized I needed to throw a chapter into the book, chapter 7, which I point out at the heading, it may be the most important chapter in the book. And it's about the fact that without Rhino collusion with the leftists would never succeed. Our biggest single obstacle to winning as conservatives, as patriots, as Christians, is the two-faced Trojan horses in the GOP who claim to be with us and prove that they're not. This is what happened. This is what you're describing, what happened when Trump first got into office and he was going to build the wall. And where's his Republican support? It's not there. The Paul Ryans, the Mitch McConnells, these people prove when the time comes, time to actually accomplish something, they find every excuse not to.
So, Christopher, this leads me to your book, Rules for Defeating Radicals. I live in San Francisco, which is ground zero for insane radical lefties. They control everything, including each and every individual conversation, because they're aggressive and they're full of ridicule and they're not shy about using it. Now, I personally don't suffer fools too easily, so I call each and every one of them on their hypocrisy. And when I do, they either go for the jugular, calling me a racist or an elitist, or they just go silent with that arrogant little smirk on their face. You know, they're used to being on the attack. But they're not so tough when the tables are turned and they have to defend themselves. Why is it that progressives feel comfortable with using hypocrisy and outright lies to defend their position?
Well, a person has to have a conscience and a sense of shame for hypocrisy to actually have any effect on them. You know, if you realize you're talking to somebody, you realize you don't have your facts together or you misquoted somebody or something, it bothers you because you want the truth to prevail. The fundamental difference between right and left, and I can go into the whole thing about this phony political spectrum that shows the Nazis on the right and the communists on the left. That's garbage. The totalitarians are on the left, and the freedom loving, honorable people with Christian principles of the golden rule and things like that, they're on the right. It is just that simple. Don't let them recast that for you. The people on the left are perfectly comfortable advancing their agenda with lies. As a matter of fact, it's even worse than that. Their agenda comes from Marx. You can even trace it back further in history to that, but in the modern incarnation, it's Marx. It was founded on lies. It was founded on an atheistic view of humanity and on the concept of promising people the world until they give over power to you to the point where they can't contest the fact that none of your promises are coming true. And so it was founded on lies. It can only be advanced through lies. And we try to approach these people from the perspective of, let's all find the truth and then we'll all get along. Well, they don't want the truth. It's not a matter of finding the truth. It's a matter of having their agenda prevail over yours by any means necessary. So hypocrisy, my second and third chapter of the book was on hypocrisy. It's not a liability to them the way it would be to me. If I realize that I'm not being honest and forthright with you, I better go back and change this, make sure I get my facts right. With them, it's, can I get away with this? If I can get away with it, doesn't matter if you call me on it, but like Hillary said so famously, what difference at this point does it make? And hypocrisy would be a liability to us, but for them, it's a weapon. It's a strategy by which they're going to gain leverage over you and me in any situation by any means.
You're listening to the AJ Steele Show, where no topic is off limits, no discussion too harsh, no truth more true. The AJ Steele Show. We tell it like it is.
All I really want to be is a guy that gets the girl. All I really want to be.
Our interview with author Christopher Adamo continues. It seems that in many ways our morality is our weakness. Now, another thing you write about is the fact that the left, with help from a compliant media and big tech, creates heroes and villains. Could you expand on that theme?
Yeah, first of all, I do want to go back and hit one thing you said there, where you said our morality is our weakness. That's not really true, and let me clarify that. I understand exactly where you're coming from, but it isn't our morality that's the weakness. It's when we let them define our morality for us. I can't tell you the number of times that I've had some leftist who embraces this vile strategy right from the pit of hell. It's pure evil. They hate everything godly, and they'll come out and they'll tell me, well, that's not a very Christian way to respond. Now, typically, the typical conservative Christian response is to, oh, well, maybe I better rethink this because I don't want to be a bad Christian. I've now accepted their phony premise, and now I got to go back and redo my statements, my words, to try and make it fit their definition of what is a Christian. That's where it's not my morality that's a liability. It's their reworking of my morality, their parody, their ugly reflection of it that they create. That's what's the weakness. So until I get beyond that, I'm always going to be trying to play the game by their rules.
Well, since you keep bringing up morality and Christianity exclusively, I do have a question for you. Many bad things have occurred in the name of Christianity, and for that matter, all other religions. And I personally know many supposed Christians and Jews who support the left and its behaviors and manifestations. Now, I wasn't going to ask you any of these questions. I didn't plan on getting into a theological discussion. But do you believe that Christianity is the only way to morality? And is that what conservatism is all about?
Ultimately, I would say the simple answer to that is yes. It does not mean that we're wanting a theocracy in this country where everybody has to profess by force to a certain belief system. When you say a lot of bad things have happened in the name of Christianity, you're right, because there have been a lot of people going all the way back to Judas who claim to be followers of Christ and then do things that aren't, and I could go throughout all of history with that. The morality of the country that respects the rights of the individual, for example, that respects the right to private property, we can tie all of those premises back to a basic moral code such as the Ten Commandments. That's why it's essential for these alternative ideologies to first come in and undermine those things. And again, you may have heard the joke that, what do you have when you have two Baptists in the same room? You have a church split. They're going to find something to argue about. That's human nature. We fall into that. But fundamental principles of the golden rule and of, again, respect for a person's inherent right, human dignity, things of this nature, those are Christian principles. Those, the founders understood those things. The whole premise of the Constitution, the way it was constructed, was an understanding of the Christian worldview of mankind, of how we acquire power, and how, if we're not careful, we abuse power. The three branches of government were done as, I always refer to it as a rock, paper, scissors kind of thing, where if done properly, if adhered to, you don't have a single branch of government that can suddenly assume power over the other two and suddenly become dictatorial. The reason things are falling apart in our country at this point is because we've abandoned those principles. I could tie back the current incarnation of the whole leftist onslaught. We could take it back 60, 70 years, prayer removed from public schools and things of this nature, where all of a sudden morality becomes, well, whatever you think it is and whatever I think it is. Well, that right there gets very, very Darwinian very quickly, to where whoever's in power is the one that dictates the morality of the day. The old thing of the twisted version of the golden rule, that he who has the gold makes the rules. Mm-hmm. And unless we have a moral underpinning to how we operate, it's going to be the powerful oppressing the weak. John Adams, second president of the United States, made a very profound statement that needs to be carved into stone and put up at the front of every court building and every school in this country. And he said that our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people, and that it's wholly inadequate to the governance of any other kind. It was done on the basis of, we're all going to work together to do the right thing, not on who can compete with who for power. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Well, I think we can argue church and state, and we can argue about theocracies, which it sounds like you don't support. But I will challenge you by saying that as someone who personally respects religions like Judaism and Christianity and other religions, I believe that morality is a part of the natural law, and it's not necessarily dependent on religion. I most certainly believe that religions give humanity a guideline and a moral code to live by. But I'm not convinced that morality and any one particular religion or lack of religion are exclusive. I believe that morality is ingrained in us and that religion and good parenting help reinforce it. But I think it would be a bit narrow-minded to say one is moral or amoral because they follow a certain god or not. That's my feeling about it.
Well, again, the founders did not seek to empower a theocracy. The number one reason for which is because you find nowhere in the Gospels where the belief in Jesus Christ was supposed to be forced on people. Now, I'm not saying that hasn't been done by many people with their own agenda since then, but that's not how it was founded.
True.
The morality of the country was determined by the founders on the basis that we do have a set of rights, right and wrongs, and there are inherent truths. You know, you see in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that those are inherent truths. Again, these can be tied back to truly Christian principles, which we, you know, all of us being a part, you know, fallen and flawed in our own ways, have not followed those things perfectly. The difference between that and a theocracy is that those provisions of law and of decency, yes, they did come from a particular worldview from the founders. But when you get to the separation of church and state, that was about that. For first of all, that statement doesn't occur in the Constitution anywhere or the Bill of Rights. But that was about protecting the churches in this country from a state that was going to come in and dictate views to them. So, you know, it was a one-way street in the sense that you can't have the Congress coming in and compelling you what to believe, which it's the perfect firewall, because you can't, as a Baptist, use the Congress to pass a law making all the Methodists in the country convert to being Baptists. And so it was that kind of a firewall. It was not, and they go back to the leftists, it was not the modern incarnation where anything that's based in Christian principle, such as do unto others as you would have them do unto you, well, that's religion. We can't have religion, so we've got to abandon that. That's what's happened in recent years, and that's opened the Pandora's box to where you have a Marxist morality that says, according to Marx, you know, the goods of and material possessions of the country, they should be taken from each. You know, they're taken from each according to their means and given to each according to their needs. Well, who is the God, I use that in quotes there, that makes that decision and comes to you and says, you know what, AJ, you've got too much property. You don't need all of it. But the guy up the street that isn't working, he needs it. So we're going to be the moral arbiter of what you own, and we're going to take that away from you. That's the Pandora's box that we've opened with the relativism of the modern age.
Karl Marx said that religion is the opiate of the masses. But what he wasn't telling people was that he was creating his own religion.
Very well stated, yes.
To tell you the truth, I'm not so sure that today's leftists are Marxists at all, because Marxism is very different from what we're seeing. I think that today's globalists are the ultimate capitalists. I think they're practicing a form of a social Darwinism. Now, getting back to your book and to our discussion about morality and order, I believe that everything that you just spoke about didn't just occur in a vacuum. The left succeeded in rebranding what we consider to be the universal order. They created a new hierarchy of morality, and in many ways, they established their own version of the truth, a sort of a ministry of truth type environment, where things like a man who puts on a dress is now considered to be a woman, and cops are evil, and the criminals are saints, and if you dare question a vaccine or even an election, then you are a racist or a traitor, right?
Again, that goes back to their premise of claiming their phony moral high ground and doing it on such a basis that your reflexive reaction, and I say you in the general sense, is typically to respond defensively to it. I go through a chapter on what I say branding heroes and villains and how they use labels to do that. Okay, you just use the term racist. You know, you're a racist if... And then I dictate the terms to you where you have to jump through these hoops for me. Otherwise, I get to call you a racist. Now, here is another example of where you have the option of either going on the defensive And our side, it's like a battered wife syndrome where we're too reflexively willing to go on the defensive. And, oh, let me prove to you that I'm not what you say I am, because I want to show you I'm really a nice guy. And I start doing all the things of, look, let me tell you all about all the black friends that I have. See, I'm not a racist. And I have this relative who's married a black guy or whatever. And I'm trying desperately to get your approval, you, the leftist, when what really should be happening is we need to call them out each step of the way on their immorality and on their hypocrisy and on their duplicity, and take it all consistently back, as you said, to the when you describe Marx as having his own faux morality that he substitutes. These people, in the sense that they have embraced that ideology, they engage in that behavior. Now, do they change it along the way? Absolutely. They're not, in every sense, the Marxist collectivist. He wasn't either. That's all about the sanctimony that they preach to us about how to be good people. You know, you've heard the statement, the leftists, the socialists, they care an art off of somebody else's back. That goes back to just one of the many lies of Marxism from the beginning, and that these people selectively embrace when the time is right for them to claim to be good collectivists, which is when they're wanting you to give away things. And then the rest of the time, they're the consummate capitalists when they're wanting to keep their own things for themselves.
Absolutely. Karl Marx came from an upper middle class upbringing. He wasn't some kind of a poor, downtrodden kind of guy. And he was being taken care of by his family and given a lot of things for free in his life. And he worked very little, which explains his whole concept of communism perfectly. Kind of reminds me of a lot of the kids here in Marin County, California, where I live. They all have rich parents, none of them hold jobs, and they all want to be communists. Oh well, it's time for us to take a short break, and we will be right back with Chris Adamo's Rules for Defeating Radicals. This is the AJ Steele Show.
AJ Steele, not right, not left. Just right.
Welcome back to the AJ Steele Show. We are here with our special guest, Christopher Adamo, who wrote a wonderful new book called Rules for Defeating Radicals. Christopher, we've reached a part where we have to stop complaining and start coming up with solutions. Let's start talking about your rules for fighting back.
Okay, the first thing that we've got to do, and I always take it back to the statement you made earlier about going on the defensive, we have got to recognize the real issue at hand in every case and refuse to let them box us in to where they want us to concede to their premise. Pick your issue. You talk about government spending, and they'll climb onto their moral high ground there, you know, as if the government isn't spending enough money. You try and cut $1 from the food stamp program, and they'll come back at you with, here's all the people that are going to starve to death if they don't get their food. Okay, now you're guilty of murdering people, okay? If you embrace it on that basis, you're fighting a losing battle. You're going to have to come back and say, okay, yeah, we got to give away all the money just like the socialists want. So what these rules amount to is we go into the situation and we stop playing according to their way and we start playing according to ours. My rule number one is, and this one is, if you don't get this one right, you're going to fail all the rest of them. Rule number one is never apologize. Never, underline it, never apologize unless an actual wrong has been committed. And then if an apology is truly warranted, if you actually did something wrong, then you remain very specific as to the issue that you're actually addressing. Because if you don't do that, you know, they come back and, well, that's mean-spirited, okay? Now, is it mean-spirited for me to tell the truth? No. The most mean-spirited thing I can do is let somebody keep operating under a lie that's going to cause them harm. But when I get accused of being mean-spirited, if I apologize, you can pick your accusation. You can make the most absurd accusation in the world. The minute I apologize for your accusation, I've validated the accusation. So number one is we stop apologizing. We stop accepting their premise on that basis. Second one is never engage leftist leaders and activists for the purpose of persuading them with the truth. The point there is that the leaders and activists already know that they're lying through their teeth. They're working on the minions with their lies. And if we try to, if I'm only going to make my case when Barack Obama admits that, yes, he's a liar and whatever else, I'm wasting my time. So what we've got to do is focus on the people who are looking. It's like they're watching a tennis match and they're watching back and forth between me and the opposition. I've got to be focusing on that audience and what they see and what they hear, because the leftist leaders are never going to concede that they're lying. Mm-hmm. Okay. Next one is never allow leftists to move beyond their hypocrisy and lies. If they start with a false premise in their question, in their statement, I've got to come to that initially, and I've got to deal with that. Because once you move beyond that and you've essentially accepted that false premise, again, you're back on their turf. You can see a pattern emerging here that we've got to fight the game by our rules and not theirs. That's the short answer for all of these. Okay, never accept baseless leftist accusations of cause and effect, which are vehemently proclaimed as inarguable truth, but are only enabling propaganda. And I used the one earlier about them claiming, well, if you cut spending, all these people are going to die. Okay, prior to all of this spending, we didn't have people dying in the streets. So that's a false premise. I'm not going to operate on the basis of trying to alleviate your supposed concern about that. Along the same lines, rule number 5, never reflexively accept leftist definitions of good and evil. They will define everything according to their terms. The next breath, they'll redefine it because the situation may change, and their first definition wasn't honest, and so the second one doesn't need to be either. Okay, this is one more for our Republicans. This is rule number 6. Power that is not asserted when necessary and appropriate is forfeited. Eventually, it is lost forever. Mm. This is where Donald Trump showed the Republicans how to do it. When he got into power, he was using his position. They were calling him names. They were, you know, coming out squalling the whole time. He's using his position to do things. What did the nation see from that? They saw him saying things, doing what he said, and then they saw results from it. And as a result, Donald Trump's agenda advanced, and then the nation benefited enormously from it. Okay, backing a little bit, next one is number 7. When leftists rally around one of their own who has been exposed for engaging in reprehensible or corrupt behavior, all who support the individual need to be identified as being equally corrupt, and they're diligently tagged as such. So when you have leftists on CNN that, you know, they stand by Hillary or they stand by Cuomo or whoever they want to stand by, they're guilty. Whatever the crime was, they have that blood on their hands because they're right in there with them. You can't say that the CNN guy, okay, yeah, he stood with Cuomo and he stood with Hillary and he stood with the election theft and all that. But you know what? Now he's talking about the vaccine. We can trust this guy because this is a different issue. No, he's proven himself to be a liar. And this is where Trump's label of fake news was so powerful, because he just called them out for what they were. And on that basis, they have been fighting to regain that phony credibility that they thought they had ever since. That's how you do it. Among the rhinos here, rule number 8 is identify friend and foe. Once a determination is legitimately made that a political player is doing the bidding of the enemy, do not allow it to be altered on the basis of emotion or polished subsequent politicking and pandering. Okay, now the case I'll give you there is John McCain. I can actually show you statements of John McCain campaigning in Arizona and sounding like the biggest border hawk in the world. Okay, we had the plenty of evidence that John McCain was an open borders. He was, frankly, he was a traitor. He had the Band of Eight or whatever, where he, Schumer, Obama, the rest of them were pushing for amnesty.
I believe they were called the Gang of Eight.
Gang of Eight, there you go. and yet he goes back to Arizona to campaign, and he's the biggest border hawk in the world. Once you figure out who these people are, if you don't keep that in mind and you use that as the basis on which to vote for them, you turn around and vote for somebody like McCain again, you deserve what you get because you allowed it to happen.
We are repeatedly letting this happen over and over again with the re-elections of people like Lindsey Graham and Mitt Romney, Representative Dan Crenshaw, who was supposed to come on our show and cancel in the last minute, and Liz Cheney. There's plenty of rhinos out there. Anyway, let's go on with number 9.
Okay, number 9, stay on target. Whenever engaged in an effort to advance a conservative agenda or seeking to confront leftist fraud and duplicity, it is crucial to stay on point and not allow leftists to complicate the issue or distract from it. Again, this goes back to them taking the issue. Let's take election integrity, and we talk about proper ID, and they're going to take it and they're going to turn it into, well, you're racist. Okay, then we're going to spend the rest of the day trying to prove we're not racist, when the real issue is, should a person going into the voting booth be verified as who he or she is? In order to have fair elections. That's the real issue. They want to prevent that. What's the real issue? They want to cheat. It's not about racism. That's their excuse. And last, and this one's a little more obtuse here, but you focus on winnable regions and issues to build momentum. this one, as crazy as things have gotten in the current day and age, this one may not apply as well as it did when I first wrote the book, because the idea is you go into the winnable races. You don't try to go in and convince Nancy Pelosi to become a good patriot American. You go in to the regions where you can reach people, where you can communicate with them, and you build your momentum from there. You know, in San Francisco, I would say it's not the city council where you do that. It's the parents going to the school board meetings. And at that point, now you've got a base that, frankly, just recently, of course, we saw how those two lefties got thrown off the school board there. You've got a base that now has some momentum. You build from that. So this is more of a strategic approach to going into battle.
Yes, miracles do occur from time to time, even here in San Francisco. And it was actually three insane school board members that were tossed out. I absolutely agree with your last statement. I think that in many ways we need to adopt a liberal talking point of think globally, act locally. Now we're going to have to take a short break, and we will be right back for the conclusion of our interview with Christopher Adamo.
The AJ Steele Show. Think of your loudmouth best friend, hated by all the wives, because he tells it just like it is.
Your love belongs to me.
Now, I do have a follow-up question about something that we didn't address yet. We all saw patriotic Americans fighting back using the First Amendment on January 6th, and many of them are still rotting away as political prisoners in, I guess I can call them, American gulags. And then we saw Canada's truckers weren't just arrested, but their financial and social lives were completely destroyed. I can't even begin to tell you how many of my listeners are telling me that nothing will save us short of a revolution. And both you and I know that revolutions rarely occur without bloodshed and a humongous human cost. Is that where you think we're headed if everything else fails?
What we have is an enemy who's willing to do anything to win. The question is, are we willing to do anything to stop that enemy? You mentioned January 6th. The biggest mistake we made there was, and I'm not trying to blow my horn here, they played the Alinsky strategy on us and we fell for it. Because the people who had advocated riots in the street, murders in the street for the year, I mean, how many hundred riots occurred in the 6 months before January 6th? Suddenly on January 6th, they're decrying violence. And what does our side do? We decry violence. Pure Alinsky, it worked like a charm on us. What we should have done on January 6th, and every occasion when they bring up January 6th going forward, the first thing, and I say emphasize the first thing, we should have focused on their hypocrisy and say, you people don't, you don't oppose violence. You oppose us getting violent to fight back against what you're doing. You're hypocrites. We're not going to apologize for anything about January 6th. We didn't do that. We started apologizing. In Canada, the truckers went to Ottawa, and they're announcing ahead of time, here's what we're not going to do. And by the way, this was a repercussion of January 6th, too. We're not going to get violent. We're not going to get violent. Mm-hmm. We're not going to get violent. What did the Canadian government do? They got violent because the truckers wouldn't go there. So you go into somebody, you go into a battle, and you say, I'm going to protect these fronts over here. This one over in the over here, you guys think it's mean for me to protect that front over there, so I'm going to ignore that to show you I'm not as bad as you think I am. Where do they come in? That's how they operate. That's how we let them get away with it. What we've got to realize is that we are at war. Now, wars in the 1500s were people lining up with sticks and bayonets and stuff. In the 1700s, they were that. And then Washington came out and said, if we fight the war exactly the way the enemy wants us to fight it, we lose. So he hid in the trees and shot at them from the trees. And they were indignant that he was so dishonorable. But guess who won the war? You know, wars change over time. If Americans had gone into World War II saying it's dishonorable to fight from the air because the only way to really fight a war as real men is to get on the ground and shoot at people, who would have won the Second World War? The war that we're in right now, and to whatever degree it goes to blows, we either have to accept that and fight it on that basis, or if we refuse to do that, we have to recognize the fact that the enemy will do that if that's what it takes to defeat us. We're in a war right now. The number one thing we can do is start fighting the information aspect of this war properly. We're not doing that. We're too often letting the left dictate the terms of the information war, and we accept it.
What's the saying? All is fair in love and war. We recently did a show about the Afghanistan war where I stated that if you go to war, you fight to win. Otherwise, don't go to war. And I agree with you. This is a war. And hopefully it doesn't get into physical violence. But it very well could. Now, getting back to my listeners, the other thing I hear from them is a fear that most Americans are sleeping at the wheel. They're completely apathetic to everything around them, and they won't start paying attention until they're literally starving. Now, you and I can talk and we can write books until we're blue in the face. But if we're being honest, it seems to me that we're already preaching to the choir. The only people listening to us are stuck in our own conservative echo chamber. How do we wake up the rest of America?
Well, okay, there's actually two aspects to what you're saying here that need to be dealt with. Number one, if the population can be maintained in apathy long enough, I actually deal with that in the book, if that can be maintained long enough, yeah, you do get to a point where you when you do wake up, it's too late. That's how they operate. That's the plan. Okay, and that, what you do when somebody won't wake up, when they won't answer the door, you keep banging on the door. That's what you have to do. The other side of that, and this is where we can actually be effective, because there's a lot of people that are apathetic, not out of true indifference to the situation, but out of frustration. And there is where we, going back to my chapter on the rhinos, is that who wants to just sit around being mad when nothing is going to happen? When you realize that your side isn't fighting effectively, the only thing you can do is either sit around and have an ulcer about it, or, you know what, I think I'm going to go fishing because I just can't sit here and get mad. That is part of the strategy. That is the reason why when in 2016, when all of a sudden you had this guy getting out there and saying he was going to fight to win, all of a sudden you had people rallying, people that weren't involved in politics previously, because not because they didn't care about the future of the country, but because they were so frustrated with continually being told by the GOP that next time, if we get the House, we're going to start governing. If we get the House and the Senate, we're going to start governing. Well, we have the House and the Senate, but Obama is president. We can't govern. And at every step of the way, they do what they can to take the wind out of your sails. I can tell you here in the heartland, driving through the countryside now in 2022, I can show you Trump signs all over the Missouri countryside, all over Illinois, blue state Illinois, outside of Chicago. It's actually the American heartland. Trump signs everywhere. Mm-hmm. People are willing and ready to fight if we have a leader who's going to fight. But if Trump was to suddenly start sounding like Mitch McConnell, everybody walks away and goes home. Why get mad? Why get ready to fight when your leader is not going to do anything except betray you? And so that's what needs to change among conservatives right off the bat. We've got to start dealing with the phonies in our midst. We are in a position. I can't get Nancy Pelosi ousted in San Francisco, but I can get Liz Cheney ousted in Wyoming when the moment she turned out to be a traitor. And so we've got to start doing that. Go to the school board meetings. We know we can win there. We've got to start doing that. And in the process, when we see somebody turn tail, show yellow, however you want to say it, because they can't take the heat, the emotional attacks, which is all Alinsky is emotional attacks. It's no more than schoolyard bullying. The people that can't take that, we've got to recognize that they are not the people that we can rally around. We've got to broom them and get good people in there. The minute you start doing that, you build momentum. That's where we're at right now. Whether or not it's too late, I don't know. But if we come out and say from the start saying, well, I'm not willing to whatever in order to fight the left, then we've already declared to them where they're going to fight the battle against us and where we're already going to surrender.
Well said, Christopher. It's been wonderful interviewing you, and I hope that everyone gets out and buys your book, which is called Rules for Defeating Radicals, Countering the Alinsky Strategy in Politics and Culture. Where can our listeners buy it?
Okay, it's available on Amazon. You go to Amazon, you do a search on Rules for Defeating Radicals, or do a search on my name, Chris Adamo, Christopher Adamo, and you'll find it there.
Thank you for that. And finally, I would like to ask you something that I ask of all of our guests. What kind of a future do you see for America? Do you still feel that there's hope, or is our nation finished for good?
I would say there's hope. I would point out again the Alinsky strategy, the leftist agenda. It always fails, and no cancer ever outlives its host. So it will fail. Now, whether or not we fail with it is up to us. There's hope, but we have got to make the decision of whether or not we're willing to fight to win, or if we're going to try and fight within what has been told to us to be acceptable limits. And acceptable limits are set for us by the enemy so that we don't win. If we accept that premise and we run it from that angle, then no, there is no hope. I think there is hope. I think people are waking up.
Christopher Adamo, Thank you so much for coming on the AJ Steele Show. I wish you all the best and lots of success with your book.
Thank you very much, AJ. It's been great talking to you.
All I really want to be is a guy that gets a girl. All I really want to be. All I really want to be is a guy that gets a girl.
The AJ Steele Show. Copyrighted 2022.